Welcome to Dialogue. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. Let's start with a hypothetical. If you and I disagree on the definition of a word, we can reach for a dictionary and find an answer. If we want to know where Vonor is, we can reach for a map and find the answer. Judges are often faced with determining whether a law is constitutional or not, but pulling down a copy of the Constitution and opening it up to find the answer is nowhere near pointing at a spot on the map. The country's best legal minds, to say nothing of cable TV pundits, opinion columnists, and the general public, don't always agree on what the words on the parchment mean. We don't have time to cover every issue that you might see erupt on your Facebook timeline, but we do hope to give you enough in this hour of dialogue to help you understand these debates and their constitutional context. For this, we're turning to Stuart Harris. He teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law, where he also serves as the associate director of the Abraham Lincoln Institute for the Study of Leadership and Public Policy. Stuart is also the host of Your Weekly Constitutional, a show that examines constitutional issues past and present, airs Monday evenings at 7 on WUOT2. Stuart, welcome to Dialogue.
Brandon, this is such a great honor. I can only think of one other radio show that I might even be more honored by, and that is being on Terry Gross.
Okay,
so I'm comparing you to the
today, and then
Terry Gross next time.
We'll
but you and Terry are my heroes.
Well, thank you. I appreciate that. Well, one of the reasons I wanted to reach out to you is you know a lot more about this than I do, and I wanted to go over some issues with you and get your legal opinion of legal opinions, basically, and how we discuss the Constitution from the top down, from the chambers of the Supreme Court, like I said, down to the general public. It's almost like a modification of the old quote, everybody talks about the weather, nobody does anything about it. All kinds of people have all kinds of opinions about the Constitution. But we're looking at the same set of words. We're looking at the same document and sometimes come away with very, very different impressions. If you would you characterize where some of those debates come from? They go along partisan lines. They go along judicial lines. What are some of the major fault lines in when we even conceive what the Constitution says?
These debates go back to well before we had a constitution. The basic timeline for us goes all the way back to Magna Carta because most of our constitutional history comes from Britain. But confining it just to our shores, the first British settlers got here in Jamestown in 1607. About 169 years later, after a long period of self-government, to a great extent because of necessity, then in 1776, we decided to go our own way. But then we were confronted with a very significant question. We're now independent, but what sort of government will we have? So we had something called the Articles of Confederation, and as the name implies, it was just a confederacy. It really wasn't a nation, and it didn't work very well. And so then, of course, in 1787, we came together a second time, and this time we decided to do it from scratch, and the debates began. And the debates are the same ones that we have today to a great extent. How should we govern ourselves is the basic question. And then, of course, do we need to guarantee certain individual rights on top of that? And those were two huge issues in 1787, 1788, and beyond. And then, you know, if we're going to have a national government, what form is it going to take? How are we going to balance powers between various parts of it? How will we constitute our legislature? What sort of powers will the president have? I mean, what's the role of the judiciary? All of these fundamental questions never really leave us. There's never really a conclusion in constitutional law. They're simply development.
Do you think that's why the Constitution has such durability at this point now? I think 232 years down the road, is it because these issues have yet to be firmly settled? There's still matters of debate.
Yeah, I think that that's certainly part of it. Part of it's also the fact that we have a written document. Ours is the longest, in fact, the first written document that people simply said, okay, here's a constitution. I'll paraphrase Alexander Hamilton. He basically said in the very first Federalist that it's been left to us to see whether people can come together and decide through reason and discussion how to govern themselves rather than having government imposed by some tyrant. And that's why we call it the American experiment. It had never been done before. And then when they decided to write it down so that everybody could look at it, that's when the wider constitutional debate really began. That happened on September 17, 1787, when they sent the Constitution to the states. And then the greatest democratic discussion in the history of the world began, according to Akhil Amar, who teaches constitutional law at Yale. And that's true. Thousands and thousands of people all over the United States, unfortunately white, unfortunately male, unfortunately mostly property owners, but still, a large number of people debated these fundamental issues, and it is a fascinating tale. And it, as we said, continues today.
I think something that's worth pointing out as we talk about the Constitution in the 21st century is, yeah, it is the product of compromise and a lot of debate, and even the framers did not agree on what it was supposed to mean or what was supposed to be in it. That may come as a surprise. Do you encounter that when you talk about the Constitution with people who think it's a firm, ironclad, almost biblical document?
That's such a great word. It is, to many people, an almost biblical document. In fact, you will see people waving it around, either literally or figuratively, much the same way that some preachers do. My relatives used to refer to such preachers as Bible thumpers. Mm. Well, there are Constitution thumpers as well. And that's certainly one way to look at it. But the fallacy is that, as you point out, that any group of 55 people, which is how many were at the Constitutional Convention, would agree on everything. And even mm-hmm. once they had compromised on particular language, then the question becomes, well, there were probably 55 different opinions on precisely what it meant. And then you multiply that by the thousands of people who participated in ratification, and then the millions, hundreds of millions of Americans today, and I bet there are as many opinions as there are people. That's just the nature of the beast.
I want to inject at this point of our conversation a concept called originalism, because mm-hmm. earlier at the top of the show I said, look, you know, if we debate where Vonore is, we can just pull out a map and say, well, there it is, it's right there on the map. And originalism is kind of similar. It's like, if we want to know what the Constitution says, let's just look at the Constitution. Tell us a little bit about this philosophy, because it's very influential in how people debate the Constitution.
It certainly is, and especially how the judiciary debates the Constitution. So let me back up just one step and say the Constitution does not explicitly say that the U.S. Supreme Court is going to be the ultimate arbiter of what it means. But I've looked at the debates over this many times, and it's implicit. And people did understand then that that's what judges do. I mean, why do we have a Supreme Court, and why do we have a Constitution that says explicitly in Article 6 that it's the supreme law of the land? Unless we ultimately are going to do what we always do with legal disputes, and that's send it to the judges. So once the Supreme Court took that up in the seminal case of Marbury versus Madison in the early 1800s, then the question became, okay, we're the authorities. How do we interpret this? And so emerging from that are a number of different schools of thought. You've mentioned originalism. Originalism is typically lumped, these days anyway, with more conservative jurists, such as the five-person majority on the Supreme Court now.
I think famously Antonin Scalia as well.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Though he had a gloss on that we can get to in a moment.
Yeah.
There are several different, I mean, the starting point for any interpretation of the Constitution is to look at the text, right?
Yeah.
In fact, liberal Justice Elena Kagan once said, we are all textualists. And I think what she meant by that is that that's always the starting point. But as soon as you need to interpret something, and the most simple clauses can require interpretation. I'll give you an example. The Constitution says that if you're going to be president, you have to be 35 years old. Does that mean 35 when you're elected? Or does it mean 35 when you take office? And we may face that question one day. The Constitution says you have to be a natural-born citizen. Does that mean you literally had to emerge from the birth canal here in the United States, or are there wider definitions? So everything is subject to interpretation. Okay, so how do you interpret it? Everyone starts with a text, but more conservative jurists will say that they are going to try to stay as close to the original meaning of it or the original intent of the people who drafted it because they see, at least in theory, the role of judges is being limited. And that's famously what Chief Justice Roberts said during his confirmation hearing in 2005. You know, I'm just an umpire. I call balls and strikes, and nobody comes to a game to see the umpire, okay? Well, many people applauded that as judicial humility. I don't know how sincere he was in that because he's been very activist since he's been on the court. Be that as it may, if you are a person who says, I look at the text, I look at the original meaning, or perhaps the original intent of the drafters, then you've shackled yourself pretty closely to what the Constitution arguably meant when it was adopted, or that provision was adopted. On the other end of the scale, the more liberal justices these days will purport to be what they call non-originalists. Their argument is basically, if we stick to the original meanings back in 1787 or 1791 or 1865, the document will rapidly lose its utility. It'll be irrelevant. Hmm. Lots of stuff has happened. I mean, the Constitution doesn't say anything about airplanes, does it? So we have to interpret it in a way that takes into account what's happened since then, And therefore, we might stray fairly far from the original intent or meaning, and we're not worried about it because otherwise the document will become irrelevant. You asked at the outset, why is it still so important today? Well, to a great extent, because all justices, regardless of what they claim to do, have to some extent engaged in creative interpretation of the Constitution to account for more modern developments.
Did the framers anticipate that, Stuart? Did they say, look, we're smart guys, but I don't know, maybe they'll invent some flying aeroplane at some point? I mean, did they anticipate that this document would have to be looked at through different lenses years in the future? Did they see that kind of durability in the Constitution?
I think they hoped for that kind of durability. And I think you're right. They were very, very smart men. Sorry, ladies, it was all men. And they must have known that it was going to require interpretation. They must have known that it was going to be something that was, if it endured at all, was going to be subject to interpretation. And therefore, I think that's part of the genius. And let me think of one. One particular provision specifically references that. There was a great debate over the Bill of Rights. In fact, the anti-Federalists, the people who didn't want to ratify the Constitution, used the lack of a Bill of Rights as their primary argument against the original seven articles. James Madison disagreed for a variety of reasons. Eventually, he decided that he was going to go along with it. But one of his concerns was that if we enumerate a short list of individual rights, we're going to forget something.
And that it might stop there.
And it might stop there. Mm-hmm. Okay, the lawyers are going to later argue, well, here are the 10, and they didn't include an 11th, and therefore the 11th doesn't exist. But if you ever look at the Ninth Amendment, James Madison said, the enumeration of certain rights in this Constitution shall not deny or disparage other rights that the people retain. I paraphrase there. Mm-hmm. Basically, it was an open-ended invitation, at least with regard to individual rights, for somebody, and that somebody obviously needed to be the Supreme Court, to very creatively interpret what individual rights might be in the future. So I think that's probably the most explicit provision in the Constitution that suggests that it's an open-ended document.
What about provisions, and correct me if I'm wrong, in the body and the articles that allow for the amending of the Constitution?
Article 5 allows for the amendment of the Constitution, but we're talking about two different things there. We've amended the Constitution through that process 27 times, which is fairly infrequent. I mean, you just mentioned we've had 232 years of the Constitution, we're only talking about a little more frequently than once a decade, and I know that the last time that happened was in 1992. Right? So it's hard to do. In fact, there's a two-stage process, each of which requires a supermajority. Two-thirds of both houses of Congress have to agree on proposed language. Can you imagine that today? And then secondly, it goes out to the states, and then three-quarters of them have to ratify. And if that's the only way that you can amend your Constitution, then you're not going to be as often called a living, breathing Constitution. Where does it come from? Through judicial interpretation.
All right, we're going to pause right there. We're going to continue this discussion in just a moment, and we'll open up the phone lines for your questions as well. Our guest is Stuart Harris, host of Your Weekly Constitutional on WUOT2 Monday evenings. He also teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University. We'll be back with him in just a moment, but first, you're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue continues on 91.9 FM WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. If you're just joining us, our topic today is interpreting the Constitution, how we make an 18th century text fit through a 21st century prism. And with this, we have Stuart Harris. He's a constitutional scholar, teaches constitutional law at Lincoln Memorial University's Duncan School of Law. You can tweet your questions to us at WUOTFM. We also have a Facebook post up right now where you can submit your questions, or you can give us a call at 974-5050. Stuart, I wanted to talk a little bit about, we were talking about the interpreting of the Constitution, and that often falls along some common lines, for instance, the freedom of speech, which has had to be asked about, clarified, you know, and nipped and tucked for, you know, a long time now, probably more than a century. I'm thinking back to Oliver Wendell Holmes, and there's probably even more before that. When we talk about interpreting the Constitution, this is a great example for me because all the Constitution says about it is 10 words in the First Amendment. Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech. Mm-hmm. And that's it. That's all the document says about it. So everything else we've decided about what we cherish or hate or love or want to get rid of with free speech comes from however we must feel about it. Could we delve a little bit more into how people may misinterpret the scope of something. Like, freedom of speech is absolute. This is this big, huge thing. And if I'm arguing with you on Facebook and you say, I'm going to defriend you, and you say, that's an abridgment of my freedom of speech, it really isn't. The freedom of speech is interpreted much more differently under legal umbrella.
Yes, it is. We have to start with what is a constitutional right. I mean, people love to say, I know my rights, and maybe they do. But on the other hand, many people don't really realize that a constitutional right has to start with government action. Because the best definition of a constitutional right I can come up with is this. Even if every single person in the United States votes to say, Harris, we're tired of listening to you, shut up, you can't talk anymore, they can't do that. It doesn't matter what a majority wants to do to me or my freedom of speech. All I have to do is hold up my hand and say, you can't do that because the First Amendment takes that issue out of the political realm. So the government has to do something bad, like trying to take away your speech or mine, before an individual constitutional right can be asserted. And I think a lot of people don't understand that. As you say, they will say, you know, my freedom of speech is being infringed because Facebook has kicked me off.
Or Twitter suspended my account. Or,
exactly.
Yeah, something
or,
like that.
Or Duck Dynasty fired me. That was a big thing a few years ago. Mm-hmm. Remember, that fellow was fired and people said that violates the First Amendment. No, it didn't, because the government was not involved in any of those things. And that's, I think, the essential thing that people misunderstand, is before you have an individual right, you have to have bad government action.
There are lots of people who say, well, that's one of the points of the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, is to protect us from government overreach on matters like abridging freedom of speech or the right of people to hold a protest or write their congressman and complain. Talk to me a little bit about how the Bill of Rights is seen as a bulwark against or a bulkhead between government and people.
Well, that's exactly what it is. Madison originally was concerned that a Bill of Rights would not go far enough, that it would not include enough rights, that it would not protect them adequately, and that ultimately it would be nothing more than a parchment barrier. I mean, if a majority really wants to take away your freedom of speech or mine, Madison thought, they're going to do it. But partly as an act of political compromise and partly as a philosophical change of heart, he started thinking, well, no, it is a good idea to write them down, or at least the ones that we can think of now, as long as we leave the list open.
Because, and there's that, what, Ninth Amendment?
The Ninth Amendment, right? That does that. Okay, exactly, explicitly does that. At the very first instance, Madison said, well, in order to protect our rights, we have to know what they are. And you've just recited several of the most important rights there, all of which are contained within the First Amendment to the Constitution, the right of speech, religion, assembly, press, petition. These are cherished rights, and I think most Americans would think that's one of the most important parts of the entire Constitution. And why do we know this? Because we can read it.
Also contained within the First Amendment is what's called the Establishment Clause.
Yes.
We alluded to this a moment ago because this touches on the federal government can't create an official state church, for instance. The Supreme Court later decided that concept applied at the state level, too. From those words and those rulings, people have come to see a general constitutional endorsement of the separation of church and state, although that is never explicitly mentioned. Where does that separation live in the Constitution? Again, we're going down sort of the interpretation rabbit hole, but where does that come from if it's not written right there in the document?
At the very least, the Establishment Clause prohibits the creation of an official national church. And it's since been interpreted also to apply to the states. And so everybody agrees that if we all of a sudden had the Church of the USA and we started taxing people to pay for it or requiring them to go or something, that's going to violate the Establishment Clause. The question is, how much more does it prohibit?
How broad is that?
How broad is that?
Okay.
Now, there are some people, typically on the right these days, Clarence Thomas comes to mind, who think that's about all it does, and that anything beyond that that the government does that touches upon religion or that even seems to endorse a religion or favor one religion over another, that's all cool because it doesn't go as far as establishing an official church.
Mm-hmm.
Now, on the other side of the spectrum, Justice Ginsburg is very, very protective of what Thomas Jefferson famously called the wall of separation between church and state. She's what we call a strict separationist, and she looks askance at almost anything that government does that touches upon religion. That gets the red flags for her, and she says if this even tends toward favoring one religion over another, or even religion over non-religion, then it's going to violate the Establishment Clause. So you see, there's a huge range of feeling. Currently, the court has four members who tend to be strict separationists and five members who tend to be less so and more accommodating, we like to say, of government actions in religion. And that's a classic case of two schools of thought, or really multiple schools of thought, colliding on this issue. In fact, Establishment Clause jurisprudence is famously one of the most messed up areas of constitutional law, one of the most difficult as well as one of the most fascinating and the most important, because there's never been a consensus within the nation or on the court on how broadly it should be interpreted.
We can use this actually as a lens into how the court can change over time. Somebody asked me recently, it's like, well, the Supreme Court's the last word. And I thought about that and I said, well, yeah, for a generation or so, and then they might decide to revisit, you know, and this has happened before in the court's history where they'll take a look at an older decision and either modify it or sometimes overturn it. The way this applies to what we're talking to right now is the Lemon Test. Could you tell us a little bit, and because this recently got changed, the Lemon Test originates from 1971, but it was changed this year. Give us a briefing on that.
The Lemon Test is the quintessential strict separationist case. The Lemon Test said, and this was, it's no coincidence it was in 1971 because that was the last gasp of the liberal Warren Court era. It said any challenged government reaction, challenged as violating the Establishment Clause, the government has the entire burden of showing three things, all three of them. First, it has to have a secular purpose. You have to be able to point to it and say, here's why we're doing this, and it has nothing to do with religion. Secondly, it can neither advance nor inhibit religion. So sort of a neutrality aspect of it. And finally, even if it passes both of those tests, if it excessively entangles the government with a religion, then it will also violate the Constitution. Now, you can see that the Lemon Test is very hard for the government to meet. That test, however, has never been consistently applied by the court because almost as soon as that decision was announced, the court started changing. Richard Nixon had been elected in 1968 on a promise to rein in all of these liberal judges, and by golly, he started carrying through with it. Ronald Reagan, similarly, George H.W. Bush, every Republican president has been pushing the court further and further to the right. And so an entirely alternate universe of constitutional interpretation has arisen even as the Lemon Test wasn't being overruled. And this is what we call the accommodationist school that I mentioned before. Well, things came to a head in the so-called Peace Cross case, where a 40-foot concrete cross on public property in Bladensburg, Maryland, was being challenged. And the court, well, a majority of the court expressed severe reservations about Lemon. And Justice Gorsuch actually said, it's time, paraphrasing here, it's time we thanked Lemon for its service and sent it on its way. They didn't explicitly overrule it, but they often do things this way. They will not overrule it because they don't want to look like they're changing course too radically, but they will all but kill it. And then 10 years from now, somebody will say, oh, well, that's essentially been overruled.
So this is for all intents and purposes.
For all intents and purposes, yeah. Lemon is dead. And, you know, that's kind of where we are right now. I mean, Lemon is probably no longer has nearly the vitality that it's had for decades.
We're going to turn to the phone lines. We have Lloyd in Norris with a question. Lloyd, go ahead.
Good morning, sir. You're touching on very sensitive issues here. My question refers to the woman problem. We are now observing the centennial of the 19th Amendment being passed, and Tennessee, of course, was the key state in the ratification process. Could you speak a little bit why it seemed so unnecessary in 1789 and 90 to include in citizenship and civil rights both men and women, why the word men seemed to incorporate all of society, and why that remains a problem today, since most women in those days were wives or wards, and today more women are single than are married.
All right, well, this takes us back to some of those debates about what was included in the Constitution and what wasn't when it was being put together.
Lloyd, thank you for your question. Sometimes when I do public presentations and this issue comes up, I will ask everyone in the room to stand. And then I will say, okay, if you are a child, sit down. If you are a woman, sit down. If you are a person of color, sit down. If you are a white man who doesn't own real property, that is dirt, sit down. And then all of a sudden the room, the only people in the room who are standing are people who look like me, old guys, old white guys. And we look around, we say, those are the people who could vote back in the day. For the most part, there were differences state to state. But for the most part, those are the people who had all the power back then. This is an issue that long predates our Constitution. I mean, women have been oppressed throughout human history. And it's such a wonderful development that in the last 100 years that we've given they've earned the franchise. We've done a series of episodes of your weekly constitutional on this, and we've leaned very heavily upon our very good friend and colleague right here in Knoxville, Wanda Sobieski, who is very, very active right now in commemorating the 100th anniversary of the 19th Amendment, and that it's really kicking into high gear now. I don't know why there's so much misogyny in the world. I don't know why it still exists to varying degrees all over the world, including in this country. But I will simply say that I applaud it. That I think the research is very clear that when women are involved, life gets better. So it's not merely a matter of respecting women and giving them their due rights. It's a matter of improving society.
All right. Lloyd, thank you for your question. Stuart, I want to. We did the First Amendment, talked a little bit about that. Oh, boy. Let's tackle number two.
Oh, boy. Number two, indeed.
Well, it's deeply polarizing. It is bitterly debated. And I want to say from the outset that I started putting this show together before the shootings that took place this weekend in El Paso and Dayton. We're not advocating for or against anything. But this is instructive because as we talk about what the Second Amendment allows and what it doesn't, that debate really lives in the heart of what the contours are, that where the nips and tucks are in the Second Amendment, because it doesn't prohibit any kind of gun regulations, but it can prohibit the scope of those regulations. Walk us through some of the nuance there.
Second Amendment is one of the shortest provisions in the Constitution. A well-regulated militia being necessary to the security of a free state, the right of the people to keep and bear arms shall not be infringed. The initial question you have to ask is this about militias, or is it about an individual right to keep and bear arms?
Because that middle part is set off with commas, and I know that's been that grammar has been the source of a lot of angst.
A lot of angst. The seminal decision, well, I will say that for close to 200 years, the answer was it's about militias. In fact, in a famous 1939 case, the Miller case, the court in passing simply said, well, of course, that's all about militias. And okay, that's what I was taught in the 1980s in law school. And then, of course, the Heller case came along in 2008.
And this was just 11 years ago, very recently.
This is one of those classic circumstances where, as you pointed out, the court can simply shift directions. And it did a 180. And it did so an extremely controversial opinion, which, by the way, involved the five conservative justices engaging in non-originalism and the four liberal judges talking about original meaning, original intent, grammar back in, 1791. I mean, it was really a reversal. In fact, Justice Scalia subsequently called himself, I believe when it was he was on a visit here to the University of Tennessee, he called himself a faint-hearted originalist. So you see, judges will say that they have a certain philosophy, and perhaps most of the time they follow it, but then when they want a different result, that goes out the window. So the Supreme Court has told us since 2008 for the federal government and since 2010 for the states that there is a fundamental right to keep and bear arms. But in that very same Heller opinion, Justice Scalia and the majority were at pains to say this is not absolute. There can be reasonable restrictions on ownership and where these guns can be brought and all the rest of it. And for the last 11 years, as you point out, we've been working our way through some of those issues. And by and large, most gun control legislation has been upheld by the courts.
Where are the boundaries? Because the thing that precipitated the Heller decision was a gun control law in Washington, D.C. So what did the Supreme Court say about that?
That particular gun control statute was very carefully selected. I mean, the people who were the plaintiffs in the Heller case mm-hmm. were very good about picking one of the most restrictive statutes, and they had an extremely good plaintiff. He was, get this now, a police officer whose day job was protecting federal judges and who carried a gun on the job. But he couldn't have a gun at home to protect his family. I mean, there's no more sympathetic plaintiff in a gun case, okay? So they were very smart about picking these. Other statutes, they take infinite form. And by and large, they are being challenged. By and large, it's in blue states because that's where gun control is more popular. What's interesting to me is that certain segments of the gun rights lobby have taken the position that the Second Amendment is absolute. And the political effect of this is that states, perhaps like Tennessee or Texas, never even bump up against the limits of the Second Amendment because they're too busy going in the opposite direction. Mm-hmm. These so-called open carry laws or constitutional carry laws or eliminating permit requirements. Remember, the government has to do something to restrict a right before that implicates the Constitution, and states like Tennessee or Virginia or lots of others, red states, are going in the opposite direction. So it's really not even a Second Amendment debate at all. It's how permissive these states are going to be with gun laws.
President Trump wants to add a question about citizenship to the 2020 census. And here's a great example of where we can look at the same words and come up with different conclusions. I was fascinated by this, that as I was doing the research for this show, I found two articles that were published on the same day, July 11th of this year. Two rival publications that live in the world of politics, Politico and The Hill. Politico said, this is blatantly unconstitutional. The Hill said, it is blatantly constitutional. First, let's begin with what the Constitution has to do with counting and why this is becoming such a focal point right now for division.
Again, it goes all the way back to the Constitutional Convention. There was the large states wanted to base representation in Congress on population. The small states wanted equal representation in Congress. They compromised. It was called the Great Compromise, creating the House and the Senate. The Senate got equal representation per state. The House is proportional. Well, as soon as you decide you're going to have proportional representation, you've got to figure out where your people are. I mean, if Virginia is going to have representation that is proportional to its relative population, then we have to count the people in Virginia and compare them to the people in New Jersey, hence a census. And that's where it comes from. And the census itself says you count everybody.
So what is the deal now with adding a citizenship question? This has some implications, not just because a census is mandated in the Constitution, but it has a connection to the 14th Amendment. Why is that significant?
The 14th Amendment made it very clear that people who are born in the United States are citizens of the United States, regardless of whether they're African American. And it's been interpreted even more broadly since then. What I'll say about that case, the particular case that was decided just this last month involving the census question, was that both sides to some extent were right. The census can include a citizenship question. It has included such a question in the past. But what is almost amusing about this one and also disturbing is that the court actually remanded the case, sent it back down, because it essentially called the Secretary of Commerce a liar. Wilbur Ross came in with certain justifications for this, and as the court said much more politely than I have just said, the facts do not match the evidence. Now, the problem is that there's no longer enough time, arguably, for the administration to come up with another justification in time to get through the legal challenges and actually have the census documents printed up. In fact, I think their first deadline was last month. And I think they've pushed it back some, but it's to the point of almost physical impossibility for them to add that question to the census. The president has vowed that he's going to keep fighting, and perhaps he will, or perhaps he'll back down as he has on other issues. But at the moment, there doesn't seem to be a citizenship question destined for this next decennial census.
And I was going to say, worth noting that if that did change for some reason, the next census is 10 years hence in
right.
The year 2030. So this may not come up again for a little while. We're going to pause right now for another station break. When we come back, the third of dialogue with our guest, Stuart Harris, talking today about interpreting the Constitution. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Dialogue continues into its final minutes here on WUOT. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth, again with Stuart Harris, who teaches constitutional law at the Lincoln Memorial University Duncan School of Law. He's also the host of Your Weekly Constitutional, which, as the name implies, looks at constitutional issues. That airs Monday evenings at 7 on WUOT2. If you're just joining us, we're talking about interpreting the Constitution, and boy, are there some ways to do that. We've been covering that throughout our two-thirds of the show already, but before we go, I've got a few more that I want to hit just to, again, the issues that are in the news, and I want our listeners to be a little more informed about when they see these topics being brought up in some kind of punditry kind of way. One of them is called the Emoluments Clause. We heard a lot about this when President Trump first took office. It is in the Constitution. What does it say? I mean, emoluments is not a word we use very often these days. What is it meant by that?
Well, the first time I encountered it, I thought it had something to do with hand lotion. and then I realized it was not emollient, it was emolument.
Right.
Okay, and then I had to go back and look it up. And it is a somewhat archaic word. Emoluments essentially are bribes. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
In British constitutional history, the king would typically offer positions, salaries, sinecures to members of parliament to secure their votes. And we didn't want that situation to arise in our country. So essentially, the emoluments clauses, and there are two of them, a domestic and international one, broadly, generally speaking, prevent that. Prevent the president from specifically benefiting from something because we're concerned that some foreign leader or some private entity here back at home is going to essentially bribe the president into doing what that person wants. But exactly what an emolument is a huge issue. There are several lawsuits pending now that are arguing that emoluments includes profits that this president might make that can be connected to his presidency. One classic example is the Trump International Hotel in Washington, D.C., which arguably attracts more foreign dignitaries now because they want the president to know that they're paying him money at his hotel, and they'll do this in the hope that he's going to treat them better politically. But who exactly gets to challenge the emoluments clause is another huge issue. Recently, the attorneys general, I think, of D.C. and Maryland had a case dismissed because the court said you lack standing. How are you harmed by this? You specifically, how are you harmed? So that case has been dismissed. I believe there's another one pending, a little closer to having standing because it's been filed on behalf of other hotels in D.C. They claim they are losing business.
Oh.
Because the people are going, foreign dignitaries are going to Trump
right.
instead. And that, they say, is a violation of the Emoluments Clause. But again, it's somewhat attenuated, isn't it? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, I mean, more money for the Trump organization, and ultimately Trump controls that, but how much actually goes in his pocket? Is this something that would actually influence him? Those are the real issues. So if we ever get past the standing issues, and there are a couple of cases that are still alive, then that's going to be the ultimate question.
And this gets to an important point, which is that the Emoluments Clause has been in since the original, even before the Bill of Rights,
yes.
the original articles, but it's never been tested in a court of law. There are other passages in the Constitution for which we just don't have any precedent.
We don't. And again, it goes back to that issue of standing. I mean, the Constitution will say that certain things should be done or can't be done, but then the question becomes who can actually enforce them? That concept of standing is designed by the court to limit itself to its constitutional role. I mean, courts are fundamentally different. The president is elected by people to go out and do good. The Congress is elected by people to go out and do good. Judges are selected in a much more attenuated fashion, I mean, ultimately by a majority of the Senate. But the courts can't do anything until cases are brought to them. And Article 3 actually says they only have jurisdiction over cases and controversies. So the court has, over the years, defined what that means. And they have said it means basically three things, that you have to have a plaintiff who has suffered a concrete and particularized injury that is traceable to a particular defendant, that's number two, and that three can be redressed by a court. That's what its jurisdiction goes to. So if I'm a plaintiff and I can't explain why the Emoluments Clause or the violation of it, the alleged violation, hurts me in particular, I don't get into court.
I want to ask, too, about another similar situation where we talk about the president and high crimes and misdemeanors. And we talk about this sometimes as it refers to, did the president commit a crime of obstruction of justice? Can he be charged? What this has never been done before. So, again, we have something on the books. We have that language in the Constitution, but it's never really been tested.
Famously, back in the 1970s, the then leader of the Republicans in the House wanted to impeach Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas, probably the most liberal justice of the Supreme Court in history. And Jerry Ford was actually a very conservative guy. And people said, well, what high crimes or misdemeanors has Douglas committed? Or do you just disagree with him? That's not a high crime or misdemeanor. And famously, Jerry Ford said, a high crime and misdemeanor or misdemeanor is whatever the House of Representatives says it is. And as arrogant and overreaching as that sounds, he was right. I mean, the impeachment process is beyond judicial review for the most part. The only real involvement occurs when the president is impeached and the Chief Justice presides over the impeachment trial. But let's remember something, though, that the House of Representatives only impeaches, and strictly speaking, that's like an indictment. It's an accusation. Then the Senate has a trial, the only penalty of which can be removal. Now, we've had two impeachments in our history, Andrew Johnson and then subsequently Bill Clinton. But in neither case did the Senate convict and remove the president from office. They came awfully close with Andrew Johnson. I think it was down to a single vote.
Yeah.
But it wasn't even that close or nearly that close when it came to Bill Clinton.
So this idea is still kind of floating out there about whether or not the president can be removed for terms that do not carry a specific definition within the Constitution. We kind of have to guess at what those are.
Look, if there is a Democratic majority after 2020, and if President Trump is still in office, that's an unlikely event, I think, that you'd have that kind of a split. I think they'll tend to go one way or the other, both of them.
Mm-hmm.
But let's just say for a moment, let's posit that the Democrats take over the Senate and keep the House, but that Trump stays in the White House. Well, then you'd have a real shot at impeachment and removal from office. But even then, impeachment or removal actually requires a supermajority in the Senate. So
yeah.
The Democrats would have to control, I think, 3/4 of the Senate before they could even hope to, or they'd have to convince a few Republicans to vote against their party, and Republicans have proven themselves very reluctant to vote against this president.
I want to ask, because so much debate revolves around, especially right now, these topics that we've talked about, the limits of free speech or the limits of the Second Amendment or the limits of presidential authority, what are some parts of the Constitution that you think are pretty important that don't get the spotlight on CNN and Fox News on the top of every hour? What's important about the Constitution doesn't get in the spotlight?
There are a plethora of issues that don't...
I was about to say, I realize the danger of asking someone who loves the Constitution, studies it as much, to talk about the lesser-known parts, but just a few.
Well, I'll talk about my favorite part of the Bill of Rights, and that is the Third Amendment. And I don't mean to put you on the spot, Brandon, but do you know what the Third Amendment says, okay?
It says that soldiers can't be quartered in your home in peacetime and not during war except under terms decided by Congress.
You are the only person I've ever asked that question to, without warning, who knew the actual answer. So once again, you are my hero, Brandon, absolutely. I call that the anti-redcoat amendment. And I posit now that that is the single most effective part of the Bill of Rights, because when's the last time you saw a redcoat? It works perfectly. It has always worked perfectly.
That is true. I was about to say, this is the old, like, you don't see any elephants around here. Right?
Exactly, yeah. Right. It's really kind of funny. I did an episode or part of an episode in the Third Amendment some years ago, and there actually have been a couple of cases where arguably it was implicated. One of them was back in World War II when United States soldiers occupied the Aleutian Islands and actually fought Japanese there.
That's right, yeah.
In order to do so, they dispossessed a group of natives and occupied their homes. And it wasn't specifically authorized by Congress. And I'm sorry to say that the soldiers did a little bit of damage as well and were not very respectful of the natives. That could have been a case it wasn't. More modern times, think of a hostage situation in House Number 1. Well, the police want to go into House Number 2.
So that they can
use it as a base of operations, and they might stay there. They might sleep there. They might use it as their quarters as well as their base. Does that implicate the Second Amendment? And I think it probably, the Third Amendment.
Yeah.
And that probably does. And so there are lots of obscure parts of the Constitution that at first glance seem to have no modern relevance, and yet when you look more deeply, they really kind of do.
That leads me to what I think is a key question here. Do you think, we talked about this earlier, that the word abortion doesn't appear in the Constitution, airplanes don't appear in the Constitution, the internet certainly isn't mentioned in the Constitution, but judges are asked all the time, you got to base it on the Constitution. Are these things legal? Are they not? Are they constitutional? Are they not? Ideas that the framers could possibly have never really imagined. Do you think we will reach a point, as technology and society continue to evolve, that we will reach the limits of what we can interpret from the words in the Constitution, at least in certain parts?
Well, in certain cases, and according to certain justices, we have already reached that point on many occasions. Anytime, and it's typically a conservative judge, simply says, the Constitution's not relevant here. There is no such constitutional right. That judge is effectively saying, this ain't covered. And sometimes the judges are very explicit about this. They'll say the Constitution doesn't protect this. Classic example, 10, 15 years ago, the Kelo case. Do you remember that case? It was about eminent domain, and a woman named Kelo was objecting to the city of New London, Connecticut, taking her house and then giving it to a private developer. And the question was, does the Fifth Amendment, which deals with these issues, does that prohibit that? And the court said, ultimately, no, it doesn't. You do not have an individual right in this particular case that you can assert against the power of eminent domain. But the judges were at pains to say, this does not mean we approve of this, and this does not mean governments must do this. And in the wake of Kelo, a number of states have enacted either constitutional provisions or statutes that prohibit this. So simply because the Constitution doesn't give us an answer in a particular case doesn't mean that we've got no recourse. Typically, you just have to go back to politics and try to get your way.
We have a question from Twitter. This one's kind of specific. Interested in how different groups interpret the Eighth Amendment and debates as they relate to prison overcrowding, mandatory minimums, other modern issues, how those connect back to the Eighth Amendment.
I'm so glad that the listener asked that question because the Eighth Amendment is a classic example of the living, breathing Constitution. The Eighth Amendment prohibits cruel or unusual punishment. Now, if you interpreted that in an originalist fashion, and you went back to 1791 when it was ratified, that would mean that we could put people into stockades, that maybe we could have public whippings, that we could do all sorts of things that were not considered cruel or unusual back then. But the court obviously recoils from that kind of thing. We could throw people into holes and throw, you know, basically lock the door and throw away the key, because people did that back then. So the court explicitly looks to what it calls evolving standards of decency, or something along those lines. And that is completely untethered. I mean, and even conservative justices will vote along with this, because the opposite result is unacceptable to them. And so the court's basically saying the Eighth Amendment doesn't help us back in 1791. We've got to interpret it in 2019.
Let me ask you, as we get ready to, we're down to our last few minutes here, to go back to the central premise of today's show, getting people to be a little better informed about the Constitution, so that if you're participating or happen to witness that debate unfolding on your Twitter timeline and your Facebook timeline, and you want to get into it, or just observing, where do we begin to go beyond this hour to talk about becoming a little more conversant, a little more educated in the nuances of the Constitution, so that we can just be better participants?
Well, Brandon, there's this radio show I've heard of. It's called Your Weekly Constitutional, and it's on Monday nights here at 7 p.m. on WUOT2. And though, of course, I'd love people to listen to this station, it's also available as a podcast. It's on iTunes and Spotify. So just Google Your Weekly Constitutional. You'll come up with one of our sites, and we have close to 400 hour-long episodes. Each one of us devoted to a particular issue, or maybe one or more issues. And that's a real deep dive. I mean, we've spent an hour today, or close to an hour, talking about a huge range of topics, and we've barely scratched the surface. You've done a great job, but we couldn't obviously go into depth.
Oh, yeah.
We try to go into more depth and in a very conversational, accessible way, and I typically interview one, two, three people in an episode, people who are leading experts in their area, and we talk about both historical and current constitutional questions. Just finished an interview on the history of religious freedom in this country that was utterly fascinating. It'll be broadcast in a couple of weeks here. We talk about things like the National Emergency Proclamation. We talked about emoluments. Mm-hmm. So if you're interested in a particular issue, you can go to the podcast site. You can enter your terms on our search bar, and you'll probably come up with at least one episode on.
I also want to throw out to go to WUOT.org after our program wraps up today, because we're going to have audio from today's show that'll be available for our listeners this afternoon. I've also put a couple of links to the Constitution Center. The National Constitution Center has
a great
lay guide to the Constitution, written to explain a lot of the confusing areas of the Constitution in lay terminology, and also the Annenberg Center for a little deeper dive. We have two links at our website, WUOT.org, where you can go in a little bit further if you would like to, or a lot bit further with that Annenberg link. And Stuart, any final thoughts as we get ready to sign off here? I mean, it's an interesting time. It's a challenging time. If anything, we know it's not new. You know, we've been through this, you know, before, and these debates don't seem to be going anywhere fast, you know, in terms of, we figured everything there is to know about the Constitution. What are some final thoughts today?
Well, Harry Truman once said that the only thing new in the world is the history that you haven't read. And I think the same thing is true of constitutional law, constitutional history. If you look at it, you see that the same issues keep coming up again and again and again in different form. And I'll add one other destination for people. I would be remiss if I didn't do this. Montpelier, James Madison's historic home.
It's just up the road in Virginia.
In Virginia. It's right near Charlottesville. It's near Monticello. You could make a double trip of it. It is a beautiful place. It's a gorgeous place. The people there are extremely committed, and they underwrite my show. Through the Center for the Constitution, which has many, many educational resources online as well. So I would suggest people go to montpelier.org, and it's MONTPELIER.org, and they can learn a lot more.
Okay. Well, Stuart, you talked about your favorite obscure part of the Constitution. What's your favorite bold part of the Constitution, or one we talk about a lot?
I think the First Amendment is probably my special
area. That's a classic.
It is a classic. Yeah. I mean, anybody who's a wonky constitutional law professor likes it. But one other area that I've gotten really interested in since I came to LMU is Lincoln's Constitution. In fact, I'm teaching a seminar called Lincoln's Constitution. And I don't think people realize how profoundly he affected our Constitution.
Ooh, we'll have to leave it there, but I'm going to be tuning in and listening for that. You're listening to Dialogue from WUOT News. Thanks to Stuart Harris as our guest, the folks who contributed questions as well. Greg Hill is our producer. I'm Brandon Hollingsworth. I wish you a good Wednesday.